The following program was produced by an independent community producer. The opinions expressed do not necessarily reflect those of the ECAT staff or board of directors.
Giving a voice to the voiceless, pulling stories out of the shadows and putting them under the spotlight, making sure that each person is valued and cared for. This is Humanity First with Peter Evers, presented by BAMSI.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to another edition of Humanity First. I'm Peter Evers, I'm the host of the show, and we have not had a show for a few weeks. So I've missed having guests and chatting away. And today we're actually going to have a conversation about the nexus of public health and mental health, and how that sort of intersects with the idea of public safety, because we've had another mass shooting in America, and that mass shooting is a little closer to home. Was it in Maine? And we'll talk a little bit about that, and talk a little bit about signs and symptoms of people who are struggling with mental illness, but also about the reality of that intersection of mental health and violence. But first of all, I'd just like to talk a little bit about what has been happening over the last couple of months in the world. And I was thinking about this in terms of how we as human beings process information that comes at us 24 hours a day. The news cycle is now unavoidable almost, just in terms of what is put in front of us. And what has been put in front of us over the past couple of months has been essentially horrific, and has really tested our thought processes about evil, I suppose I would say, and about the response to evil. And of course, we're talking about wars that are happening on many fronts in this country, the Ukraine, Russia, violence that is happening, numerous countries in Africa struggling with political overthrow. I think of South Sudan, and of course, in October, the Hamas murder of many Israelis, and the subsequent reprisals that have been happening and is still happening in Gaza, where Palestinians are losing lives by the hundreds every day. And I think what has come out of this is the natural split of those people who support the Israeli situation and what has happened to them and the murder of them and the despicable acts of that. And then the other side, if you like, who support the Palestinian people who are innocent victims of the Israeli counteroffensive, if you want to call it that. And I was thinking about this, and in some ways we can hold sympathy and we can hold empathy for more than one group of people. There is no question that what is happening in Gaza and Israel at the moment is horrendous. These are, as somebody the other day said, these are evil acts. We don't talk necessarily about evil people, but these acts are evil, and we should be horrified by them, and we should be taking action about them. We saw last night that there were hundreds of protesters at the one of the book prizes, who got together and said, we need a humanitarian ceasefire in Gaza. And I would agree with the sentiment about that. But I think as human beings, we have to hold that those acts in our heads and see them equally as acts that are destructive to a people. The value of an Israeli baby is exactly the same as the value as a Palestinian baby. And we have to come together, and we have to fight back against what is our acts of evil in the world and call them that. And I think the voices of the reasonable and the peaceful have to get together and say that's not tolerable in a world where really we promote peace and the idea of being able to live a life without threat. And there are many more of us that feel like that than don't. We'll be right back.
Giving a voice to the voiceless, pulling stories out of the shadows and putting them under the spotlight, making sure that each person is valued and cared for. This is Humanity First with Peter Evers, presented by BAMZ.
Welcome back, everybody, to Humanity First. My name is Peter Evers, and as promised, we have a guest who is no stranger to this program, Lee Whittemore, who's a Vice President of Behavioral Health and Community Services. Hi, Lee. How are you doing?
Hey, Peter. I'm well, thank you. Thanks for having me. How are you?
Yeah, it's great to have you on. And for people that don't know BAMZ particularly well, Lee is the catch-all for clinical, I would say, someone who is always willing to sort of step into the breach and provide services and advice for people when we are dealing with tragic circumstances. People may have been reading the news over the past couple of weeks, but BAMZ ourselves had a terrible tragedy recently with the murder of one of our nursing staff who was much loved. And spare a moment for the family of Maggie Mobitu, for Rose, her mother, who also worked with us. And our staff have been absolutely rocked by this outrageous act. And to have somebody so young cut down in the prime of her life, somebody who was really the American dream, if you think about it, somebody who came to this country in 2007, started working at McDonald's, got a job as a frontline direct care worker, became an LPN, and then became an RN. And she was one of the brightest personalities that many of us have ever known, and we shall miss her greatly. And I know, Lee, that your team have been wonderful in terms of offering support to those persons served and staff who knew Maggie, and there were so many of those people. And I just wanted to publicly thank you for that. I think that's really wonderful that we have that resource of your team. So thank you.
Oh, thank you. I'm very grateful that we're in a position to be able to offer assistance.
Yeah.
Such a tragic situation.
It really is. And when it when it comes home and it's on your doorstep, it makes it all the more poignant. And I think a lot of the things that I think when you do work with trauma, you talk about shattered assumptions. You know, we all think that we'll come to work tomorrow. We all think that the world will work as it usually does, and that we'll see the same people. And you know, one of those trauma responses is that you're suddenly struck by the fact that there's an intrusion into your world that is so devastating, and many of us are feeling that at the moment. And you know, I mentioned at the top of the show that we are dealing with another mass shooting that has happened this time in the northeast of America, which we're less used to, I think, than many other places in America. And this particular one was up in Maine. It was a guy by the name of Robert Card. And I think everybody knows the details of it. Many lives lost in a tiny town where people knew each other. And, you know, the mundaneness of the evil act, if you like, sometimes strikes us just as much. You know, a bowling alley, a bar, you know, places that people frequent on a regular basis. But Lee, I'd like to ask you a question. I think we often find ourselves in the middle of a conversation about public health on one side, mm-hmm. and public safety on another, and there is this tendency to run conversations together about mental illness. People who present with mental illness are often described as a public safety risk, and they are sometimes. But to me, it sort of sidesteps the issue of the consequences of mental illness, untreated mental illness. Communities and cultures that don't put enough resource towards mental illness, and so we get caught up sometimes in saying, well, you know, this person was mentally ill. That doesn't tell the whole story, right? Because
absolutely,
because we know that so many of us struggle with mental illness, mental health disruptions all of our lives, and violence isn't a part of that, and oftentimes more likely to be violence inflicted upon the self, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
absolutely.
So what are we looking at here? What, how do we begin to tell a story of separating those things out, but also maybe bringing them together when they do happen? We can't ignore the fact that untreated mental illness at times can result in violent actions like this. But talk to me about the majority of people who struggle with serious mental illness are not violent, right?
Right. I think the majority of people who struggle with mental illness are, you know, dealing with just managing their symptoms. They're isolating, whether it be anxiety or depression, and they're seeking help. I think this is more of an isolated case. And I think, you know, it appears to have gone on for a longer period of time and untreated. I know that in this case, he was hospitalized for a period of time. And there were certainly enough warning signs and enough people saying we're concerned. But in this, you know, in this case, it seems like something broke down in the system. There were enough people, you know, making noise about it and trying to get him help.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. People, you know, I think as when we do sort of postmortems, if you like, psychological postmortems like this, there is a collection of things that happen that when you put them together are signs that maybe we should have been, you know, taking more interest in this. But it's interesting because some of those signs, right, are seen in people who are not violent at all. So it is a bit mm-hmm. of a conundrum like that, isn't it? It's like, you know, you might see somebody who's withdrawn. One of the things in the Robert Card situation is that the parents reached out, I think, to the PCP, to the doctor, and mm-hmm. said, we're really worried about our son because he's withdrawing from us. Now, taken in as an individual action, there are many people who withdraw from their parents. There are many people who do that because of mental illness, but the vast majority of those people don't go through and commit a violent act, right?
Right, right. And I think in this case, you know, the parents reached out with a concern, and that's exactly what they should have done, you know. And I think, you know, when someone has homicidal or suicidal ideation, you know, we can't always say, well, if they do this, they're more likely to act out, because people present differently. There are some people who don't say anything at all. And there are other people who exhibit more outwardly signs. You know, they might be really verbal, experiencing increased paranoia that they talk about. Maybe they're making verbal threats. So in those cases, I think that would increase the likelihood that they're gonna act on those feelings. But I think any time that someone is experiencing, you know, homicidal ideation or suicidal ideation, the people around them need to take action, take it seriously, try to get them some help.
Yeah, I'm gonna sort of tiptoe into a very sort of controversial area here, but there is also that association with gun ownership in this country and mental illness. I remember the last president, you know, sort of saying that, well, you know, maybe we should go back to mental institutions where people are locked up again. And it was a backward step in many ways for all of those advocates for people mm-hmm. With mental illness, remembering that it's very unusual for an individual to go through the lifespan without experiencing some sort of mental disruption or illness. And yet there is a conventional wisdom about that. When we talk about homicidal and suicidal ideation and acts, we talk about lethal means, don't we? That mm-hmm. idea of something that is so destructive, something that is designed for the destruction of a human or an animal, being available to somebody who has those impulses is very important in the plot, isn't it? Because impulsivity, for instance, is something that we see an awful mm-hmm. lot in somebody who is struggling. You know, I think about the boyfriend whose girlfriend has just ended that relationship as a teenager, that there is an impulsivity that we should be expecting from that. So the lethal mm-hmm. means question is an interesting one, isn't it, around availability of a gun, which is, of course, the thing we described as the instrument of right. killing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there is. And, you know, mental illness, you know, untreated is the variable, you know, or it's the trigger. But the gun is the means, you know, the means for them to act on that impulsive thought, you know. I think it goes back to just, you know, mental illness being untreated, someone not getting treatment in time.
Do you think stigma comes into this? I ask you that because when we talk about small communities, and we hear about this a lot, right? The true sort of spirit of America is that people look after themselves, people know themselves in little towns and villages, and with Lewiston, you heard that. Not that Lewiston is a little town, but it's a small city. But there was this message like, oh, everybody knew each other, that, you know, we knew each other's business, we looked after each other. And yet, he was an individual who probably 5, 6, 7 times came to the attention of authorities, people doing what they said they would do, which is what you talked about before. Mm-hmm. And yet still we missed those signs. What is it that we should be doing as communities to be more aware of this? And do we not talk about it because there's still a stigma about mental illness that doesn't exist with, I don't know, diabetes, for instance?
I think you're right. I mean, I think stigma probably did play into this. You know, I think people need to talk more about it. They need to normalize the conversation. You know, mental illness is an illness, just like diabetes, high blood pressure, you know, and if people are getting treatment for that, it's their own private medical information, you know, but when people are acting outwardly in a community setting, and other people are taking notice, in a small town or any town where they say people take care of each other, then I think that people should have conversations and really not be afraid to talk about it. Mm-hmm. You know, I read some of the articles and I think that family members and friends were afraid that, you know, by acting out or getting people to help, that it would make the situation worse. And when someone's having active symptoms, in the moment it might make it worse, but if they get treatment over the long term, it's going to help the situation.
Yeah. You know, you're responsible for one of our programs, which is the First Episode Psychosis Program, which is this amazing evidence-based practice intervention with young people who have a first break. And, you know, a first break probably happens, between the ages of 16 and 25, something like mm-hmm. that, oftentimes mm-hmm. with the onset of schizophrenia or whatever. I'm always amazed that parents don't come forward. And we know that the likelihood of an early intervention with First Episode increases the better outcomes for those people exponentially. But we're not doing it, not because we don't care about our kids, but we don't want them labeled as schizophrenic, right? And so mm-hmm. obviously you're going to hold off on that because we have certain ideas about somebody who struggles with psychotic disorder look like and do, right? And that's, again, wrapped up with the issue of public safety and public health.
Right. And I think many parents struggle with that label and the stigma and hoping it will go away, hoping it will improve.
But how far have we come since, you know, lobotomies? How far have we come with second, third generation antipsychotics? You know, it isn't the story necessarily that it was even 30 years ago, right?
Right. It's changed a lot. And, you know, if people could, you know, focus on treating the symptoms rather than the label, I think that would go a long way in getting more people the treatment they need.
I love that, focus on the symptoms, because we do that with everything else, right? We absolutely mm-hmm. do that. One thing, and we only have a minute or two left, but I am still baffled at the number of deaths that we have from gun violence every year. And I'm not just talking about mass shootings. I'm talking about the ease of access to weapons. And I'm not getting into a conversation about the ethics of that or the law or the philosophy of it. But when we look at similar populations in different countries where they have different ideas about possession of and ownership of guns, we don't see the same amount of murders, and we don't see that kind of carnage. It's not an easy question, is it? There isn't, mm-hmm. I mean, politicians are going to say it's gun violence. Some people are going to say we're not spending enough on mental illness. We just need to spend a little bit more time looking at the nuances of this and having an open and honest conversation about how we walk ourselves back from a situation where we just almost shrug when we hear of another mass shooting.
Mm-hmm. I agree. And I agree with what you're saying. I think we need to have an open dialogue and just, you know, have everyone around the table and just really start exploring how can we improve this and learn by maybe what some other countries are doing.
And finally, I think just ask how people are, right? When we do mental health first aid, the thing is like keep asking people. And even if they say, "What it's none of your business," don't back away. If you think there's something wrong, allow somebody the opportunity to say, "Yes, there is," and then act on that and get them into treatment.
Yes, absolutely. And even if you ask once and they say they're okay, ask again a little while later because things change. Things happen in people's lives every day that can affect their mental health.
Wise words, Lee. Thank you so much for coming and talk to us a little bit. I think we'll be having more conversations about this in the future. And we all remain hopeful that that we can work on this as a community and a culture. So, Lee, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me. Take care.
Everybody. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye.